This is the Deep Dive with Brooke Spector.
And yes, this is the Deep Dive, and I'm Brooke Spector, as I am every Friday. Well, actually, I'm always that, but Friday at 9 o'clock, we have this program. And today we're delighted to have Dr. Iraj Abidin, an economist, businessman, advisor to government, thinker about the future of the country's economy and larger questions, as our guest. Over the last several weeks, we've had conversations with several other people, Yaki Sillier and Patrick Bond, about the nature of the political economy for South Africa, especially with regard to the BRICS summit. But it's important, I think, that we get a serious, you know, hardcore, real, tough-minded economist to talk about these questions as well. And none better than today's guest. Iraj, he's the founder and chief executive of Pan-African Investment and Research Services Limited and chairman of Pan-African Capital Holdings. That means a lot, I think. And he was a professor of economics at University of Cape Town before he went into business. His academic background, of course, is from Cape Town and Simon Fraser University in Canada. And that, if my numbers are correct, that's now 30 years ago that you finished up your PhD. You've been working since. You've been a consultant on economic policy issues publicly, privately, and internationally. You've had a hand in all the major government thinking about the country's economy since then. I don't want to read the whole list. It'll be embarrassing to everybody else who tries to be important. And he is the author of numerous books, articles, think pieces, and he's even done a stint at the International Monetary Fund, working on issues related to fiscal vulnerability. And he was with the Standard Bank as well, and on and on and on. Man has credentials like very few other people do in this country, and they're real, and they're not just the honorary kinds of things. And we're delighted to have him on our program today. And thank you, Iraj, for making time for us.
Thank you, Brooks, and greetings to our listeners. And despite all the kind readings that you did, I still remain a student of economics, because as soon as you think you got it, the situation changes, so you have to go back to the learning phase to re-understand the changing environment. But thank you very much for the opportunity.
Is it really the dismal science that we think of it as?
It is a bit of a dismal science, complicated by a more dismal field of politics and global geopolitics. So it's dismal multiplied to the power of 2 and 3.
Okay. So anybody who feels the need for some caffeine, time for it right now. Let's sort of break this into the conversation into three things. We have local issues we need to talk about. We have sort of regional questions. And of course, there are larger global pictures. But let's start with the local. As almost anybody who's ever looked at a newspaper in the last year, or watched TV or listened to the radio or just chatted with their barber or hairstylist, we understand that the South African government has extraordinary budgetary and fiscal challenges ahead of it right now. And there are arguments that the government will be seriously carving back on various kinds of spending, merging government departments. What are the most important challenges? If you were in charge of it all, what would you do first?
I think the biggest problem, or the biggest symptom of the problem, which is a deep and complicated problem, but symptom is very simple. Government revenue is running way short of budget, way short of its needs. Needs being existing commitments and possibly additional commitments. So as we speak, government has suddenly woken up that their growth projections is about less than a third of what they were hoping for. That means tax revenues are not coming in. That means borrowing is going up, and that means a whole lot of expenditures such as welfare payments, pension payments, health system, you name it, are becoming theoretical. There's no money for it. So that's a symptom. The real cause of it, Brooks, is not that simple, but the fundamental cause of this symptom arising and appearing now beyond any doubt is the fact that for nearly 10 years, a bit longer perhaps, our growth has been under pressure. Our growth, meaning economic growth, meaning job creations, meaning enterprise development, etc. And that in turn is because our investment has been lacking, not only by the private sector, but more importantly and more critically by the government sector. Government knowingly has always said, we need to do this, we need to do that, and then do nothing. We need to professionalize the public sector because service delivery suffers, but they've gone the other way. They've said right, they've gone left, or they've said left, they've gone right. There'll be no rails, not up to standard, quantify how much the need for investment is, and yet do nothing. Wait until the rail services system gets more deteriorating. We know our urban infrastructure is poor, our water supply, our ports, our electricity, you name it. So government has been fully aware of what needs to be done, and yet it has failed to do anything about it, sat in it on his feet, on his hand, as they say. And that in itself, then a symptom of another problem. And that is within the cabinet, within the governing party, there is a split. They say two ways, maybe more than two ways. And that means they cannot come to a coherent position to do things and do it properly, professionally, and get the economy going. That's a short answer to your question.
Well, I mean, part of it, I mean, you know, if you were to apply our good friend Mr. Occam and his razor, wouldn't we just say, all right, if we need more money to do things, why don't we send money and or borrow more money and just spend it and do the things that you quite correctly identified as things that need doing? Why not just do all those things?
Well, as a matter of fact, back in 2009, 2010, 2011, they did exactly that. They borrowed huge amounts to bring energy capacity, Kusile and Medupi. But look what happened. The money was spent, but in the name of electricity, but it was stolen in a daylight. Instead of building more capacity, they built more liability. Our debt ratio, public debt, went sky high, went nearly, was heading for 80%, but as we speak is 70% of GDP, which meant in the name of building or investing public infrastructure, such as energy, such as roads, such as housing, such as water. Just look at how many billions of rand in the name of water was squandered and siphoned out of public sector. I mean, the Zondo Commission is now for everybody to see, to read, and it's no longer accusation or speculations. These are matters of facts that government and especially President Ramaphosa has acknowledged that state capture basically hollowed out, never mind investing, they hollowed out all the borrowed money. And that's important, which means we created response liabilities for future generation, for our children and their children, but we don't have energy for them. We don't have water for them. We don't have roads for them. We don't have railways for them. We don't have passenger railways for them. So that then brings us to a current situation where we have run out of borrowing capacity. We have run out of taxing more because individuals are now top tax at the top level. And if you tax them more, more of them will leave the country. So you end up in a vicious circle. At the moment, one of the fastest growing, unfortunately, trends is the young, capable and competent people, black and white, who are leaving the country. Why? Because their tax rate is too high. Not only today, but if trends are not arrested, you don't have to be a rocket scientist or a specialist to know that your taxes in the coming years are going to go even higher. So do you stay here or do you go somewhere where there is a better prospect? So government has exhausted these ways. What they haven't done is the point that you mentioned, print money and spend. Well, printing money, to some extent they have done, to the extent that the Reserve Bank is accommodating it, but the Reserve Bank is very, very clear. And the governor is, at pain to point out that printing money and trying to buy your problem out or dig yourself out of a hole by printing money is only going to lead to inflation, more impoverishment, and inflation is the enemy of the poor, most and foremost. So I think that's not an option, not because it's what the governor says, because countries like Zimbabwe, like Europeans have done it in the past. That is not a solution. And so, yeah, we find ourselves, unfortunately, back to my first point that I made, in a quagmire of indecision by the cabinet, number one. Number two, a culture of incompetence within the public sector, which doesn't make investments to pay off, to finish on budget, on time, and deliver. For example, Kusile was supposed to have cost us 89 billion, if my memory serves me right, back in 2011-12. And now, 12 years later, that 89 has become 282 billion and is not finished and is not functioning and is not feeding into the grid. That is the extent of incompetence and abuse of public resources. When a government finds itself in that situation, it's got a big problem.
We're speaking with economist Iraj Abedin, and this is The Deep Dive, and I'm Brooke Spector, and we'll be back in a moment.
This is The Deep Dive with Brooke Spector.
This is The Deep Dive. I'm Brooke Spector, and my guest this morning is economist Iraj Abedin. Always a pleasure to speak with him because he speaks right from the heart. He doesn't fool around with his opinions, nor does he fool around with his recommendations and his ideas. And it's a pleasure. Before we took our break, Iraj was identifying fiscal crisis, the government, the country that we find ourselves in. Let me tweak it slightly for you and ask you the same thing in a very different way. People are always talking about the idea, and they have been since the early 1990s, the developmental state, and borrowing the mythology of the developmental state as relates to China, which had in fact borrowed the idea from the four little dragons of Asia, which of course had borrowed the idea from Japan. So that puts it right back to the 1960s as a concept. And we talk here often, and you hear governmental types speak about the developmental state. Is this a chimera, or is this a real possibility? And if it is, why isn't it happening?
Brooks, it's not a chimera. It's a real, but there is one major requirement without which it's just hot air. One, and if you look at the Asian tigers that you refer to, Japan, South Korea, Singapore, and others who went the route of developmental state, the major requirement is a competent public sector. Competent to the point of telling the politicians that you're wrong, it cannot work, this is the way to build the road, this is the way to get the port, this is the way to create electricity, etc., etc. If you do not have a competent machinery or infrastructure of state, not government, state, meaning Department of Roads, Department of Trade and Industry, Department of Education, Department of Health. That is what I mean by the state. Those countries have, and they still have, you mentioned Japan. Japan is one of the most competent public sectors by any standard. Singapore is almost the benchmark of a competent, efficient public sector. Now, South Africa doesn't have that. South Africa wants to have a developmental state, like wanting to have a solid house, a solid fortress, but on a very flimsy, sandy foundation. It's not going to work. And that's why Kusile costing us four times what it should, and we got nothing, because there isn't competence to manage that. That's why Department of Health gets the budget, but the hospitals are in a mess. That's why Department of Education cannot deliver on its mandate. Department of Housing cannot. Trade and Industry cannot. It's not as if we are not spending the money. It's important to note that by emerging market standards, South Africa spends more per capita on health, on education, on all these social goods. But look at the outcome. Look at the developmental output and outcome. It speaks for itself. Why? not because developmental estate is a wrong idea. It's the requirement is not in place. It's at the expense of belaboring the point, it's like saying, can one not travel from Cape Town to Johannesburg or Johannesburg to Polokwane with a vehicle? Shouldn't we get on the road and go? Yes, but your vehicle must be trustworthy. Your vehicle must be roadworthy. Your vehicle must be properly maintained and properly fueled, etc., etc. But what happens if you don't have that vehicle? Every few meters, you have a problem. You never get to the destination. So the idea is a good idea, but you must say, what does it need? At the moment, National Development Plan of South Africa, 11 years ago, launched by the current president under Zuma's administration, one of his first requirements is to create a capable state as a requirement of a developmental state. 11 years later, has that capable state become more capable or less capable? By President Ramaphosa's own admission, repeatedly, he is suffering from lack of capacity. So my question to Mr. President is, 11 years you launched it, why did you not make the state that you had accepted in the NDP a requirement of developmental state? Why are we not making that a capable vehicle to travel in, using my example?
I think part of the answer, of course, is I'm one of the few people you'll run across who actually read the whole National Development Plan, you know, all 4 million pages of it. And I even sat through two briefings about it with, you know, hundreds of PowerPoint slides and everything. I even got a CD from somebody about it. But one of the key challenges in a developmental state model is that politics has to be firewalled away from bureaucracy to a considerable degree, and interest groups, not political parties per se, teachers unions, public service unions, have to find the means to understand the compromises that are necessary. And that, in the broad sense of the word politics, that seems to be the missing part of that very heavy book.
Absolutely. And South Africa now has got this fairly incongruent oxymoron of wanting to have a developmental state without a capable machinery of state, governmental capability, competency, etc. And overlaying that with unions wants to have a say, NEDLAC wants to have a say, NGOs wants to have a say, and everybody wants to pull it different ways, and government, much like a rabbit in front of bright lights, is sitting on his hands, hoping that Gada will arrive and development will emerge. That's just, that is the chimera. That is inexplicable expectations, which unfortunately our politicians have not resolved.
Not far too many people worry that their particular rice bowl will be broken and in the process of filling somebody else's. And there is, I think, a competition among all the interest groups, politics, as I say, in a very large picture, in which there is no national consensus about what must be done to make this work.
Brooks, the unfortunate and highly detrimental consequences of the picture that I just explained, and you mentioned it, is that the longer you procrastinate making tough decisions, the more you erode social trust and destroy social capital. In other words, the trust of, call it citizenry in a state dissipates. The trust of business confidence diminishes dramatically. The trust of labor unions on the leadership, business on union, union on business. So the whole society becomes, unfortunately, the antithesis of development. It becomes a contested, fractured sort of community with very little social capital, and government ends up becoming less and less capable of delivering to the developmental needs of the society.
And now we know why economics is called the dismal science, don't we?
Correct. Because economists, they end up at the crossroad of this multi irreconcilable talent currents.
We're speaking with Iraj Abedin, economist, business person, advisor to government, teacher of economics, many, many more things. I want to change the topic slightly. A couple of weeks ago, the country was mesmerized almost about the glittering possibilities of the BRICS summit and what it would deliver and its expansion and how that would totally rechange the international financial and economic and even political universe. Was it oversold just ever so slightly?
I think yes and no, as a good economist. On the one hand, it's an inevitable phenomenon in a global geopolitical environment where we have a reversion to a multipolar global order. We've had over the past 20 years, dating back to the collapse of the so-called Eastern Bloc and USSR, we had a globalization process that became monopolar, that the Western Bloc, more specifically the US dominance, created a kind of integration which was productive, which was constructive, which promoted growth, diminished inefficiencies in the system, and it looked as if we're going only one way. There was only a dominant paradigm. Now, over the past few years and the past 10 years more specifically, that dominant monopolar American-driven or American-centric world order has become less and less viable and driven primarily by structural change in the global economy. China has emerged as a second largest economy, fastest growing for a long time. India has emerged. Emerging markets have registered good progress, which means American share of the global economy has become a third of what it used to be. Now, in that situation, America wants to still to rule and to dominate. The other countries are saying, you're not the only player in the game. The world governance institutions of the UN in the process, which date back to 1940s, early 40s, post-Second World War, they've become ineffective, inappropriate, and not fit for purpose in today's world. So you have no global governance that is credible. You get then manifestations of it. America invades Iraq. American bombs the NATO bombs the hell out of Libya, Afghanistan. They cut deals. Then Syria. Russia invades this one, Crimea. Russia goes into Syria, and it's a complete chaos. So in that situation, everybody loses, but emerging economies lose more, and amongst emerging economies, Africa loses even more because it misses on the opportunities. It ends up as a sort of unwanted, unwilling victim of this confrontation between China, South Africa, U.S., China, the West, Russia, etc., etc. So in that situation, a question of a countervailing force in the name of BRICS was born. It was initially without South Africa, subsequently with South Africa, and then they realized that even including South Africa is not good enough. Other African countries don't just trust South Africa to protect their interests. And other Asian countries don't just trust China and India to support, to protect their interests. And Latin Americans or South Americans don't trust Brazil be their representative. So they want more. They want to have a say in the global affairs. So have they oversold it? No, they have latched onto an inevitable process in the global changing geopolitical environment. Can they do what they want to do in the way that they want to do? No. So they have obviously overestimated their abilities and their capabilities. They can exert political pressure, they can create social pressure, but they do not have the technical requirement of becoming a contestable player.
We're going to take another break, station identification. Be right back. I want to follow up on what Iraj just said after this series of messages. We'll be right back.
This is the Deep Dive with Brooke Spector.
This is The Deep Dive, and I'm Brooke Spector, and our guest today is Iraja Beaton, economist and thinker about things political economy. Lots of real-world experience in this matter. And before we took our break, he was busy unraveling or opening up the various threads that have led to the push for both the original formation of BRICS and then its more recent expansion. Let me pose a question to you about this expansion. Some of the new members strike me in particular as quite odd. Argentina may well be the single most dependent on the IMF nation on the planet. It's had, I think the number is 17 different bailouts over the years, and is hardly a paragon of economic competence and management. It's got two pairs of nations, Iran and Saudi Arabia, that are largely at sword's point with each other, even if the truce in in Yemen seems to be holding to some degree. Egypt and Ethiopia are half ready to go to the battle over the waters of the Nile. And the general quality of human rights observance in its old members, Russia, China, and the new ones, Iran, Saudi Arabia, Egypt, Ethiopia, is hardly something to write home about as a good example. Is this now becoming an institution or a grouping or a dinner party in which all the guests are about ready to throw food at each other?
Dr. Brooks, if I just add to your observations, as we speak, India and China, the two largest members of BRICS, have border disputes. In the latest map that was issued, China has claim on Russian territories. So there is no really shortage of conflicts amongst the member countries. But then the bigger conflict is here. These countries do not have, and they do not share by any stretch of imagination, the same value systems. For example, Iran and Saudi Arabia, they have not only their old ideological Islamic type of interpretation, but China's Muslim treatment is not what Iran and Saudi Arabia can support. You can't have the type of human rights values and principles that are enshrined in the South African constitution, in terms of which the South African government is obliged to conduct itself, are totally incompatible with what Iran espouses, or Saudi Arabia, or Russia, or China, etc., etc. So I think the conflicts are really creating an oxymoron of a basket of countries that have almost no value convergence, but they have one thing in common. They all don't like the way America treats them. That they, more broadly, they don't like the way the world order, as driven by the Western bloc, is treating them. That's, they have a common so-called, and I hesitate to say enemy, because the U.S. is not the enemy of India or South Africa or Saudi Arabia. In a bizarre way, U.S. And Saudi Arabia have been the strongest allies for the past 80 years. And Saudi Arabia owes its existence to United States. And India is by no stretch of imagination the enemy of the United States, or vice versa. So, and yet they have a common point of contention. Let's put it more appropriately, a point of contention that they find unacceptable with the world order that is seen to be driven by America and the Western bloc. That is their only thing that binds them. If you leave that out amongst themselves, they have nothing in common. And when it comes to economics, which is closer to my heart, South Africa is a good example. South Africa is dependent on the Western bloc for its foreign investment, for its high value add exports, such as motor vehicles, such as petrochemicals, such as pharmaceuticals, anything value added, which is part of our national strategic objective of not selling our commodities and selling value add. We cannot sell it to India or China or Russia. We can only sell it to the Western bloc. So our economic interest depends on that.
I was going to ask you to go on about that. Yes.
Yeah. So if AGOA goes, which is a preferential access for our pharmaceutical and for our motor vehicle and for our petrochemicals to America, we lose billions and billions and literally tens of thousands of highly paid jobs, not jobs. What? At the same time, we have a trade with India and with China, but those are not the trade that we want. That's selling commodities, unprocessed, low value add. And yet we have to do it. So we find ourselves, and I'm using South Africa as an example of this club of countries, because we are focusing on South Africa. South Africa is really a split halfway. For foreign investment, more than 90% of our foreign investment comes from the Western Bloc. Germany, France, UK, US, and Japan, of course. But our trade on a low value outside goes to China and Southeast Asia and Japan. So where does our economic interest rise? We don't want that, putting it different ways. And yet South Africa has been put here to be seen as if it's fighting against its own economic interest. And therefore, the South African government suddenly says, "Shoo, I've been thrown into this vortex. I've never had this experience. I don't know how to manage it." Our diplomats have no clue of the managing this complex and navigating these uncharted waters. So one day they want to host the AGOA summit. The following day they want to host a BRICS summit. And we take pride in both of them, and not seeing the conflict in that process. And that's what South Africa is caught in.
I find that what you're saying parallels very closely the kinds of things I've been thinking and writing now for some time. But let me pull yet one more thread out of this tapestry for you. And this, there was a boom in the conversation, started 6-8 months ago, something called de-dollarization. And the irony, of course, was that the BRICS New Development Bank publishes its statistics and data in dollars, and dollar-denominated trade is the basis for almost all the members, new and old. And even statistics that are issued from places like China often use the dollar as its measuring stick rather than renminbi / yuan, because nobody will be able to figure that one out. And the dollar, of course, is the reserve currency, not just because it comes from a big country that's large and in charge, but because the dollar is, generally speaking, transparently tradable. It's secure. Your investment in dollars or dollar-denominated securities won't go up in smoke every afternoon if you're not paying attention. And it's the last refuge for funds that are seeking a stable place to be parked. Where does this de-dollarization come from, and does it have any life in that phrase at all?
I think de-dollarization has been happening, partly, as I alluded to before, because the share of the American economy in the global GDP has declined to about roughly 40% of what it used to be. So de-dollarization is inevitable. For example, the formation of Europe and the introduction of a single European currency meant that many of the reserve banks held euro alongside gold and alongside US dollars. So immediately de-dollarization began at that point. So our reserve bank, including Federal Reserve of the United States, including Japan, not only they held gold and US dollar, but also held some fraction of it in euro. And that euro increased its proportion to the extent that the European bloc became a bigger player in the global economy, and the American economy became a smaller by definition. The faster others goes, the lower becomes the proportion of American share, even if America grows. America grows at 3%, the rest go at 6%, so the relative share of American GDP comes down, therefore the relative share of US dollar becomes less in terms of trade, but not in terms of the international finance system. International finance system cannot have a new currency until and unless the base, the jurisdiction of that currency becomes credible, reliable, trustworthy, and more importantly, from a people's expectation, acceptable. For example, all the leaders of BRICS countries, from Ramaphosa to Putin to Lula to Chinese to Indians, they keep their private wealth in US dollar as we speak, either in cash or in bank accounts. And yet they go and say, "We want to de-dollarize." That's true. It has to de-dollarize. The answer, the question should not be, or the issue should not be de-dollarization. The question should be, what does the current global economic environment, financial environment needs, a new currency? What are the requirements of it? And then follow from that.
We're going to take another quick station break. We're speaking with Iraj Abidin, economist, political economist, thinker about the future. This is The Deep Dive. I'm Brooke Spector, and we'll be right back after this message.
This is The Deep Dive with Brooke Spector.
This is The Deep Dive, and of course, I'm Brooke Spector, your host, and we're speaking today with Iraj Abidin, one of my favorite economists in this country. He's tried to put some light on the dismal science for us and to give us some insights into why things can improve and why they have not yet so far, which I think is laudable and a lot of heavy lifting going on. We were talking about this theme of de-dollarization, the bubble that came up and then went away in conversation. And he made the important point, I think, the critical one that's often ignored, is that even if in simple trade terms, other currencies are taking place, taking a share of things because of the general change in the relative relationship of gross national products between the various countries, in the financial sector, the dollar remains a stable reserve currency because of all the characteristics that it has. And he noted the interesting comment that leaders in the various BRICS countries keep their own personal wealth largely in dollars, whether it's in a bank account or in a sofa, I guess. But one of the things about this that always struck me as being ignored was people always talk about the strength of the Chinese renminbi yuan, and yet it's a managed currency. It's not free floating like the dollar or the pound or the euro or the yen or the rand. It's managed by a committee in the Chinese government, and they determine what the exchange rates will be, and everybody simply has to dance to that tune. That makes it unsuitable to be a basis for a reserve currency. Is that fair to say?
I think with respect, it's a little bit more complex than that. For a credible currency, you need to have a regulatory environment legislated beyond politics and beyond institutions so that those who invest in that currency or they keep their wealth in that currency, they have recourse irrespective of institutions and irrespective of the political parties. Now, that is called the so-called jurisdictions or governing capital market legislation, solvency legislation, and a whole host of other regulatory binding, constitutionally embedded kind of financial regulation. Now, China doesn't have any of that. As we speak, more than 40% of Chinese banks are bankrupt, but they've kept alive with government. More than 60% of municipal finances are worse than ours in South Africa, and yet nobody cares because nobody's wealth is kept in that. So India is more or less the same. Brazil is the same, etc. So we need to go beyond a question of whether it's governed, managed by a group of a committee or managed by a bank. What are the legislation in China that keeps the bank alive or doesn't care about the bank's solvency? What are the recourse that investors in China have or in renminbi have if they're outside China to claim back without any kind of interference? Now, those are absent in all these countries. Russia doesn't have it, etc. And oddly enough, the only country that has it is South Africa. But South Africa is so tiny in this global configuration. So yes, managed Chinese currency is a symptom of the lack of the required financial infrastructure and capital market regulations that provide certainty beyond political wishes and preferences. And that's where the problem lies.
You have just given me a whole new collection of weapons to use in this discussion that I had up till now sort of slid over under the rubric of managed currency. You've given me a reading assignment too. I have to go speak with Chinese experts now to get a full measure of all this. Let me circle back to the, to where we started, with South Africa's economy and its economic growth and its prospects. And we covered the desire for a developmental state and the lack of capability to achieve it. What we didn't really fasten onto was the question of what do we do to change that, to change that problem, away from being the insurmountable problem that it seems to be, to being, a much smaller kind of hill that can be surmounted, that can be so that goals and objectives, even in a limited way, can be achieved. If you had your druthers, if you were in charge and you could point to what would you do, almost regardless of the political cost to the political masters?
Yeah, I think Brooks, I'm glad you raised the circle back, because all that I said and others have said, including National Treasury, does not mean that the matters and the challenges are insurmountable. In any situation of this nature, and I've had the privilege back in 1993, 94, 96, 97 at the transition to democracy to be able to confront that issue. And issues were a lot more complex at that time, but the answer is remains the same. What do? You build on your strengths, not on your weaknesses. What are our strengths in this economy? We have a globally rated and respected financial system. Our capital markets are well regulated. Our Reserve Bank is well respected by global standards. And that is the beginning, number one. Number two, our corporate governance framework, our capital market, not just JSE, but also all the related legislations are globally benchmarked and in the top 5%. And definitely in the top 10%. So we have a private sector that's got over 120 years of credible history and institutions. Despite all the criticism that we can throw at them, that's a capability in the country. We need to build on that. We have a constitution, very importantly, amongst the best in the world, and certainly since. So where those are the strengths that we need to build up. And despite all the damage to our infrastructure in the energy and ports and rails and so on, there is a sufficient, in my view, modicum of a skeleton to build on. So you begin there. You begin saying, how do we quickly and how fast and credibly not talk about it, but do it. Get your rail back on track. Can it be done? Of course. Can it be done through Transnet? Absolutely not. Can it be done through the Department of State Enterprises? Forget it. They have failed over and over again. Can be done through a concessioning. Of course, you can do it within 3 months latest if you do it properly. Can you concession, retain government oversight? Don't give up ownership, but put it at the mercy, at the service of developmental approach. Can the ports be turned around within 6 to 12 months? Absolutely, but not through Transnet and through Department of State Enterprises. Concession it out, bring private sector expertise, not just money. Can we get a lot of our other infrastructure up and running, energy included? Yes, but you need to change the pace, not talk about it. A lot of impediments to our energy is still driven by that inefficient, incapable public sector machinery, broadly speaking. So if we begin to do that and get our private sector to see a light at the end of this tunnel, then they invest for their own good. For example, unless we get our ports in a credible way, turn it around, not immediately, but in the next 2 years, I cannot seek in good conscience and approve a project for investment that depends on the rail to get me to the port, or depends on the port to export my fruit or my shoes or whatever, or machines or petrochemicals that I want to export. So we need to be very practical, throw the ideological stuff out of the window. This hot air of mission, vision of political nature should be replaced by the credible vision, mission of on budget, on time, competently managed. And with that, of course, comes a lot of these balancing act that we want to do must be put aside. That requires political courage. That requires commitment to the national objective of developmental state. And short of that, we'll talk about it another 10 years and we get poorer, weaker, and less credible.
Hey, Raj, I was going to ask you to issue a summing up, but you just did that for me. It was just exactly right. It was what I was hoping you would say. We've been speaking with Iraj Abedin, economist, thinker, prophet, I guess at this point, and scolding grandmother of the state. I'm trying to find the image to describe you at this point. You know, you've got you're pointing your finger at the bad guys and telling them to, you know, get with the program.
Beyond that, one, my last point would be, I'm trying to be a servant more than anything else, but not mincing what matters for the national interest. We cannot mince our word. It's not partisan attack on anybody or any group, any party, any individual. It's a statement from an economic point of view. If you ask me as an economist, that's the way to do it. Don't blame the foreign forces. Don't blame East Russia or India or America or Britain. It's us. Look in the mirror. Do the right thing. The right output will come.
You heard it right from the man. There it was. The blueprint on what to do next. We've been speaking with Iraj Abedin, economist and thinker and advisor to government over many years, showing a certain sign of impatience at this point with all the nice talk, but so little action. You've been listening to The Deep Dive, and we'll be back again next week with another discussion with another important person, an expert, a thinker, on another topic of interest and import. And I hope you'll tune in again next Friday at 9 o'clock.